Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In a recent Adbusters blog, unnamed authors lamented the loss of the Occupy movement. They wrote, quote, burned out, out of money, out of ideas, seduced by salaries, comfy offices, book deals, old lefty cash, and minor celebrity status. Some of the most prominent early heroes of our leaderless uprising are losing the edge that catalyzed last year's 1,000 encampments, end quote. But is this really what happened to Occupy? The movement has suffered several blows, to be sure, from the media, city government, police, and internal divisiveness. But Occupy is still very much alive. If you just do a news search for Occupy, you'll find things like Occupy movements in Minnesota and California preventing foreclosures. A few days ago, occupiers targeted Governor Brown's Sacramento loft. On Monday, Occupy Nuke demonstrations were held in towns and cities across the United States, marking the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. There's an article today about Occupy Delaware folding up their tents after a 9-month protest. And a local politician wrote a letter to the editor saying, "Thank you, Occupy, for your symbolism. I might not agree with you, but you have spoken to me every single day for the last 9 months and reminded me that as an elected official, I took an oath to protect the public trust." So what is the state of Occupy? You've got an article last week in the New York Times Magazine, a widely read article by Jonathan Mahler, and he focused on Occupy Oakland as one of the last strongholds of Occupy activism. And we'll talk about that piece on today's show. Today, we're talking about the conversation about the economy and inequality. How has that changed since Occupy launched? What does Occupy stand for today? And what is the state of Occupy? Today's guests, Jen Waller and Tom Hinsey, are in the middle of a road trip doing legal solidarity trainings and working to raise awareness around issues of state targeting. Their project is called Less Wall, More Street. Jen Waller is an activist and legal worker, and she's been organizing with Occupy Wall Street and helping with legal support since last October. A founding member of the Occupy Wall Street Anti-Repression Committee, Jen educates activists about the history of political repression in the U.S. And Jen joins me here in studio. Hi, Jen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Great to have you. Tom Hinsey is an activist, writer, and photographer. He started working in the Occupy Wall Street kitchen in New York's Liberty Square in October. He's also been a part of the Direct Action Working Group, planning a number of actions, and he's written for Tidal and Occupy Theory. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks.
Great to have you. And we're also joined by Michael Terry. He's a health worker who lives in Oakland. He's been a political activist since the early 80s, and Michael is a member of the Occupy Oakland Medic Collective, which provides first aid services to protesters. He's also a member of the Anti-Repression Committee. Hi, Michael. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
So it's great to have all of you. We haven't actually done an Occupy show in a couple of months. For people who are wondering what's happening with Occupy, as the media sort of says, it's dead. You've got this lengthy piece in the New York Times Magazine that came out on Sunday. How would you describe the movement? You're in the middle of a road trip. What are you seeing out there? What are people telling you, Jen?
Well, I mean, we've been to, I think, 12 cities at this point. And, you know, working with Occupy Wall Street in New York since October until the day that we left on July 1st for the trip. And what we've seen is that it's nowhere near dead. I mean, people are still doing things all around the country. And, you know, for some reason, the media and those in power keep screaming that it's dead and gleefully declaring over and over again, Occupy is dead. But what we've seen is that it's very much alive, but it's they're trying to kill it. It's, you know, it's being killed and they're trying to make it look like a suicide. But it's not. I mean, everyone is doing all sorts of creative stuff. There's, you know, actions several times a week still in New York. In Minneapolis, the home foreclosure defenses are alive and well. But it's a movement on the defensive right now.
Yeah, that quote that you had at the beginning was obviously written by someone who had never been a participant in the actions and was just waiting for the opportunity to diss us publicly. The thing that we did lose was the encampments, which were our symbolic gathering point. That's what really drew the public's attention and helped us draw large numbers of people there. But the encampments were a symbol. And so the next stage for us is to get past doing things that are symbolic and do things that are really material, keeping people in their homes, taking back land, taking back housing, and really trying to change the system here in the United States.
Well, and in some parts of the country, they still had encampments.
Yeah, I didn't even know about Delaware.
I didn't either. I just did a simple Occupy search, and they're just folding up their tents this week after 9 months. There's this quote from Lynn. She's 57. She lost her job in late 2010 as part of a corporate downsizing. She said, my initial drive to be part of this was that I was angry, but since coming here, my anger has changed to do something different and to help. So you got that, and then I'll read part of this story from a politician who is thanking Occupy Delaware for basically being in his face every day for the past 9 months. I wonder where other encampments are still alive.
Well, you know, I think that's a really interesting quote from Lynn in Delaware, because it really points to the fact that a lot of people had this really righteous indignation for all these terrible things that they had suffered through the economic collapse in the last few years. And what Occupy did was it channeled that anger into something that was really positive. And one of the things about the encampments was we saw that there was a tremendous amount of positive creation going on, you know, people feeding each other, people giving each other clothes, you know, Michael, with the medics, you would know, like, you know, taking care of each other, you know, teaching each other. That's why we had the libraries in the encampments. So when they wiped out the encampments, it wasn't just wiping out, you know, that symbolic place for us. It was also taking away a lot of things that we were providing for each other that the state hasn't been providing.
And I'm reading this piece. Actually, Lynn was the first person to pitch a tent and the last person to take hers down. So how would you describe the state of the movement across the country based on what you've seen? What are you hearing from people?
Well, we're hearing about a lot of trumped up legal charges. Mm-hmm. That's what our project is focusing a lot on. We really are trying to collect as many of these stories of state repression as possible, because right now they're pretty diffused in the media and also within activist circles. But there's a lot of really harsh repression going on. One great example is in Minnesota, where they're doing really great work around foreclosure defense. A few people nonviolently blockaded a house to prevent the eviction from happening, and they were charged with rioting for that.
Were they able to prevent it?
Those cases are still going on, but that's just one example of a lot of that sort of thing that we've been seeing.
Well, here in the East Bay, they, you know, some people get in a shouting match and the police charge them with a hate crime. And they have to post enormous bonds, which is money we don't get back. We pay it to a bondsman to get them out. And then when it comes time for their trial, oh, never mind, it wasn't really a hate crime and there's no charge at all. Other people, they charge them initially with having explosives, set really high bonds. It gets in the front page of the newspaper, and then when they finally get into court, oh, there's no explosives, never mind. But so I think that the local political leaders have been using the legal process, the prosecutorial process, as a way to, you know, defend the 1%, charging people with outrageous things, charging people with resisting arrest who did nothing except, you know, sit down, and trying to sap all our resources with legal defense.
And what is the state of Occupy Oakland?
We still meet. All the committees are functioning. We have our general assemblies twice a week. We just, about 2 weeks ago, had our biggest general assembly since May Day. And, you know, we're continuing to organize. And with the foreclosure defense group is working on getting people back in their houses. We not long ago had the Gill Tract occupation where people up in Berkeley had taken this large piece of land to try and do urban farming and were displaced there.
And I understand, Michael, I mean, you're a longtime activist, but mm-hmm. I understand that this really woke you up again.
Yeah, it brought me back. I mean, I'd been involved in things for a long time, and my wife and I, when we heard this was happening, we showed up the first day, and, you know, it's been nonstop.
So how do you assess the overall movement 9 months since it launched in New York?
To me, the most important thing about this movement is that whereas all the movements we had back from the 80s and through the 90s were essentially single issue campaigns, where we set a clear target, we were very, you know, focused on being realistic in what we could achieve, and we'd come back. And then at the barbecue after the demonstration, we realized that all the organizers have a broad perspective, a broad approach to politics, and are anti-capitalist and recognize that capitalism is the problem. Well, but, you know, no one would want to say that out in the open because that, you know, that just, we thought that wouldn't work. Well, now we have a movement that is explicitly anti-capitalist, and it's going to stay anti-capitalist. So I think that even though we didn't achieve in a short period of time a transformation of the country like what we saw in Egypt and Tunisia, we have changed the debate, and we have made people in the United States realize capitalism is the issue, and for the next several years, that's going to be the struggle, is openly against capitalism.
Well, we've already have listeners calling in, so I'd like to give out the phone number. What are your thoughts on the state of Occupy? When I told a few people I was doing the show, they said, well, what are they doing right now? What are they standing for right now? So if you're involved in Occupy, we'd love to hear from you. If you watch from the sidelines, if you were a skeptic, what are your thoughts today? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. How have they changed the conversation about the economy and inequality? And what role do you think Occupy should play in the coming months? We're in the middle of a huge election come November. What are your thoughts on that and the connection to politics? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from David Giesen, who's calling in from Bernal Heights. He's with Occupy Bernal. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So what's happening with Occupy Bernal?
Two things I would say, I can say. One, we've had a good deal of success in forestalling foreclosures, in arresting evictions, and indeed just, I believe, yesterday or the day before, we can take some credit for having had, I believe it was Wells Fargo, reconfigure a loan with one of our neighbors. We have 80 families and their homes in foreclosure within a half-mile radius from the top of Bernal Hill. And what distinguishes, I would say, the Occupy Bernal community from perhaps other Occupies, I feel confident of this, is that it's well over 50% of the membership are homeowners themselves. That is, they're folk who already have security, and for a host of reasons, evidently have elected to support their neighbors who are in a similar predicament. So whether it's, you know, imagining into the future their own circumstance that is a motivation, that may be partly the case, or some other more altruistic impulse, and I'm not denigrating either side of that, that's a curious distinguishing aspect of the Occupy Bernal. But in addition to our active work in preserving our immediate neighbors in their homes, Occupy Bernal also has a fairly vigorous education program. And just last night we hosted a meeting, well attended, about 15 people. And we meet monthly. And where we are heading is towards an advocacy of socializing land rent. The property tax does that to a certain extent, but what we are coming to see is that what we mean by occupy is occupy land itself, and by land itself we mean that not abstract quantity known as land rent. And to socialize something that's a function of the growth of community, that is, land values rise with the community, not because of personal private endeavor, we see that as really what is the measurable quantity of community. Measured in dollars, it's land value itself. So we're tending towards a broader discussion of advocacy, of abridging the property tax to socialize land values.
And David, let me just ask you quickly before we get to other calls, what role will Occupy Bernal play in the election? For example, we have a tax proposition on the ballot in November.
And there's a couple actually out there. So which are you referring to? Parcel tax, of course.
The sales tax and Jerry Brown's tax measure.
Oh, okay, the big one.
Right.
That big one. I don't think Occupy Bernal as a movement is going to have much at present to say. I can speak for, again, the conversation that's been had in the Occupy Bernal education work group, if you'd like to hear that.
Well, we actually have a number of people on the line, so I want to get to other callers, but we've had a few people call in and just say, there's an election coming up. Is Occupy going to take part in politics?
The education work group here is going to.
Okay.
And if you'd like to hear that, if that's what you're inviting, I'll happily speak to that. I don't want to speak on behalf of Occupy Bernal broadly.
Right.
There's a significant number of membership who have been in a conversation around that, but I'm not comfortable speaking on behalf of Occupy Bernal as a monolith.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, David. We've got full lines, so I want to get to a few more callers.
Thank you
so much. And then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Zappa in Oakland. Hi, Zappa.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I was calling. I found out about this program earlier today. In the midst, we're having a long conversation here in Oakland regarding the Occupy movement and whether it accurately represents the people of Oakland in terms of racial and economic disparity, because Oakland's a city of mostly people of color, but the Occupy Oakland movement is predominantly white, as it seems like it is in a lot of places. And there's been a lot of tension, and I find myself in the middle of that tension as a black person who also is a supporter and member of Occupy Oakland. And I'm hoping that that conversation will become not just about capitalism, but about the fact that there has been an ongoing depression and repression in communities of color long before the crash of 2009. And while it's good that people are becoming aware of these issues and even addressing some level of racism within this country, there still is a real lack of listening to people of color within the Occupy movement.
Do you feel, Zappa,
leadership of people of color within the Occupy movement? And
Zappa, let me ask you: do you feel like you're heard? And what happens when you raise these issues?
I made myself heard, but I also have made a lot of enemies just by speaking what I see as the truth. Now, let me be clear: there are plenty of people of color working in Occupy Oakland. There are people of color who do not agree with my assessment, but the tension is high. The thing that happened Friday night at the Art Murmur, which I was witness to as a participant in the Art Murmur, in which there was an action that kind of disrupted a black community event that was happening, and a lot of Occupy folks, and I mean, technically it was not an Occupy Oakland action, it was a activist action, but the community saw it as a bunch of white people smashing up stuff in people of color areas, or at least a lot of the community did, and that's not really helping the community perception. I've definitely heard because I'm loud and I speak up, but I'm not necessarily listened to.
Well, actually, stay on the line, Zappa. You're talking about the FTP event at Art Murmur, F the permits, F the police. What are your thoughts on Zappa's comments, Michael, saying that he feels like he's not being heard?
I mean, all of us will at any given moment feel like we're, not heard as much as we want to. I think that, the number of people of color involved in Occupy Oakland, corresponds with the racial breakdown of the city. I think 28% of the people residing in Oakland are African American, and at least 28% of the people who attend, a lot of the sessions and who are in the encampment are African American. We've had a lot of participation, especially on May Day, the Dignity and Resistance March, which is a immigrant organized event coordinated with Occupy Oakland. And so they were part of the 5,000 or so people that marched through Oakland together. So, I mean, the event that happened Friday night, I wasn't there, but my understanding is they went to the Obama headquarters, which is in downtown. And, you know, downtown is everybody's downtown.
And what happened at the headquarters?
Someone trashed the windows of the Obama campaign headquarters.
Oh, okay. Did you want to jump in there, Jen?
Yeah, I'm just so glad that that you called in and brought this up, because I think that it's not talked about enough. You know, we are anti-capitalist in the Occupy movement in general, but there hasn't been nearly enough of an emphasis on racism in this country, and especially, you know, in this day and age where you know, so many people say we're in like a post-racial society because of having a black president. Which is obviously not true, as there are 2.5 million people in prison who are disproportionately people of color, and 6 million people on leashes, you know. And so I think that it's so important to be talking about, especially talking about police in the context of police occupation of black and brown communities. And so many people within Occupy are just, you know, are young white people with a certain level of privilege when it comes to law enforcement, waking up to the fact that, oh, the police are not just here to give me directions when I'm lost. You know, the police are here to keep people in line and enforce social control. And, you know, once we step out of that small boundary of being in line, suddenly they're not with us anymore. And, you know, so many people are realizing that now, which I know to a lot of people is late, and it's annoying and very slow to watch people have these realizations about the police and law enforcement. But it's such an important process. I mean, we need to let people have these realizations as they come. But we need to be talking about it in a context of, you know, this country, people of color are adversely affected by almost everything, more so than white people. So,
and in Oakland, it, you know, in the African-American community, when the cops get out of control, they don't just tear gas people, they shoot people in the back, like Alan Bluford, you know, a teenager who was gunned down as he ran away from the cops, you know, accused of some, you know, minor infraction. And because he ran away, they executed him.
Did you want to jump in, Tom?
Yeah, I think that it's a hard realization for a lot of people to have, but it's really easy when you're out at a protest and all of a sudden you turn around and a cop is chasing you, bearing down on you and smashing your face in with a baton, you know? I mean, that's when the realization can't but happen, you know? And unfortunately for a lot of white people, that's the first time they realize that the police aren't there to protect them, you know? They're there to squash dissent, and dissent, you know, comes in a variety of forms, whether it's being in the street protesting or whether it's being, you know, a population that's targeted for oppression by the state.
That is Tom Hensey. He's an activist, started working in the Occupy kitchen in New York's Liberty Square in October. Jen Waller has been organizing with Occupy Wall Street. They're in the middle of a road trip doing legal solidarity trainings and working to raise awareness around issues of state targeting. The project is called Less Wall, More Street. We're also joined by Michael Terry, health worker who lives in Oakland. He's been a political activist since the 80s. He says Occupy woke him up, and now he's a member of the Occupy Oakland Medic Collective. We'd love to hear from you. We have one line open, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that depends on engaged listeners. And you can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question on yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. And that's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about messages and tactics that change minds about the environment. We'll speak with Annie Leonard, creator of The Story of Stuff, and Jonas Sachs, author of Story Wars. We'll talk about how environmental messages are created and which ones really make a difference. What really stands out for you, inspires you, maybe even changes your mind and gets you to act. That's on Thursday, and then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And so far, we have Michael Hastings booked. He's a reporter with the Rolling Stone, and we'll be talking about media coverage of events in Afghanistan. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the Occupy movement. We don't hear much about it, but if you do a search, you'll learn so many things. California occupiers just targeted Governor Brown's Sacramento loft in protest over foreclosures. There was a story in the Minnesota Daily called Occupy Saves Homeowners. Occupy Homes show support to homeowners facing unjust foreclosures. There's a piece about Occupy Delaware. They just folded up their tents after a 9-month protest. The first person to pitch a tent was a 57-year-old woman who was laid off in 2010, and she's the last person to pack up her tent. So there's so much going on around the country. What are your thoughts about Occupy and what it's done in terms of the deep dialogue about the economy, about inequality, about unemployment? Where do you see it now? If you were a member of Occupy, we'd love to hear from you. If you were a skeptic back then, what are your thoughts today? 866-798-8255. We've got full lines. We'll have a couple open in just a few minutes. We also have our website. You can post yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Tom Hinsey and Jen Waller are in the middle of a road trip doing legal solidarity trainings and working to raise awareness around issues of state targeting. Their project is called Less Wall, More Street. Michael Terry is a health worker in Oakland, and he is a member of the Occupy Oakland Medic Collective, which provides first aid services to protesters. And I just want to thank you again for calling in, Zappa. And let's take a couple calls and then we'll get responses. Let's hear next from Cynthia in Berkeley. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I just want to say that Occupy Berkeley, as far as I can understand, after road trip, still meets every Monday night, and there's a knit-in on Saturday noon, 2 p.m., and tomorrow night, Thursday, we're showing a film at the Berkeley UU Fellowship on Benita and Cedar called Occupy the Bay, which is a rough-cut screening of a documentary film by John Riley and Kevin Pina. The filmmaker will also be there. So just want people to know that, at least in my head and heart, it's still an old person. It's still alive, and I know that it's going to, you know, maybe we just I just need a little patience on everything as well.
Well, Cynthia, one of her colleagues was just saying, you know, what does Occupy stand for? What would you say to her?
Is it someone else or is that me?
That's you. Go ahead. I was just asking you.
Oh, well, I just think as someone who will not be around forever, well, none of us will be, it just is that moment that something is changing. Something will change, you know. From our corporate culture, and that people took a stand. That's what it means to me, that we're going in a direction that is, even if it's kind of under the radar in many ways, and we would expect that from our corporate media, but to me it just represents that a change is happening, and the conversation has changed. Everybody says that, but it's sort of, it's true, but you got to bring it up yourself. I just was on a road trip around the country, and you have to bring it up yourself because people's consciousness is just perhaps into survival and what they hear on the corporate media all the time, too. So that's what it is for me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Cynthia. Thank you. We've got an email from Wayne, and he says, I'm an old radical from the 60s, stuck on the sidelines for the past 30 years until the Occupy folks got me energized again. I, too, have heard the complaint that Occupy lacks focus because of too many target issues, but the underlying commonality can be summed up in four words. Corporations are not people. Well, thank you for that email, Wayne. And let's hear next from a different Cynthia calling in Berkeley. Hi, Cynthia.
I'm Cynthia.
Hi, go ahead.
No, you've got another Cynthia on there.
No, you're on. We already had Cynthia. We have two Cynthias. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's all right.
All right. That's me. I'd like to
And if you please turn down your radio and then it'll all make sense.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry. Just close it. Yeah, I'm a 60s person, too. In fact, I know the other Cynthia. We both live in Berkeley. What I found when I started with Occupy pretty much in the beginning was what we've all found. We encamped in a place where homeless people already lived. And from then on, what we saw was Oakland. The idea that the people in Oakland know the problems. People of color have lived with the police, with poverty, with all kinds of things for a very long time. And I have been, as Zappa has, concerned for a very long time that we aren't pushing this kind of leadership. Right now, there are foreclosure committees, very, very active. Anti-repression is very active because from the very beginning, the city government and the police have made absolutely sure that we had no time for anything but to defend and protect ourselves from them. And I've done a lot of research on Oakland PD. I'm part of the research team and have learned a lot about the connection between the city and the police and real estate development in the downtown area. Hmm. And
did you know much about that before?
No, I didn't. Hmm. I just knew that Oakland PD had a bad reputation. And from the people that I've known, one thing about Occupy is you will meet the most wonderful people you can ever imagine that you would never probably meet any other way. And there are people who have been living with OPD since they were kids, being targeted in West Oakland and East Oakland. And so it's nothing new for them. They know what's going on. But a fairly new twist is that the business investment districts, which are essentially real estate development, and the city and the police are all basically trying to get Oakland, downtown Oakland, gentrified and producing money, while the Oakland Police Department is 6 years late in meeting federal standards, standards set by the Federal District Court on Civil Rights. The city's paying $3.2 million a year to the court to keep that going rather than the city taking charge of the police department. I could go on.
Well, Cynthia...
The cops do sit down with real estate people and advise on how to hardscape so that homeless people won't have a place to sit.
Well, thank you, Cynthia, for calling in. You raised a number of issues there. And I just want to get a couple more callers, semi-related, and then we'll get responses from our guests because people have been waiting. So let's hear from Janet in Oakland. Hi, Janet. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. I wanted to talk about a new Occupy Bay Area United, OBAU, O-B-A-U, that started out of a break-off from Occupy SF. After the April 30th destruction in the Mission District and the inability to disavow itself from that action because of the decision-making process at OSF. Let me just read the mission statement of OBAU. It's a nonviolent direct action people's movement whose mission is to galvanize the public to replace the domination of our lives by economic and political elites with equitable, humane, and sustainable systems. So one of the main ideas is a commitment to nonviolence. And we have adopted a diversity of strategic nonviolent tactics. And so that's explicit. And we have GAs every Sunday at 5 p.m., and we've been alternating the GAs between San Francisco and Oakland. So that's, I can talk more about it.
This is just new? This is just...
It started on May 4th, and people can go to obau.org, O-B-A-U.org, for more information about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Janet. And just to be clear again, GA is General Assembly, where a number of people meet and dialogue about tactics and what's to come.
Yes, General Assembly is a essentially a democratic form of decision making that uses consensus process, but it's also just a forum for recognizing and having people's voices who are usually marginalized heard.
Would you like to address some of the comments that came up? We also have a number of comments actually about racism and Occupy. Barbara in Bernal says, it's a little troubling to me that the anti-capitalist movement can be seen as separate in any way from anti-racism. The capitalism that we live with in this world is built on racism and sexism. It's probably most accurately understood as racist capitalism. We have a couple of emails from listeners who say the Occupy movement needs to do a better job dealing with racism and not just capitalism.
Well, I agree with the emailer. And if you come to our General Assembly, you'll find we are talking about racism every, you know, at every assembly and in everything we do. And, you know, sexism, discrimination against gays and lesbians and trans people, all of whom have played a very prominent role in the movement. You know, we're against patriarchy, we're against racism, and we're against, you know, capitalism and oppression of all peoples. One of the callers brought up the police, and I just wanted to let people know more than 1,000 people have been arrested in the Bay Area, almost 800 of them in Oakland, and that's really dominating a lot of our time, is doing this anti-repression work, supporting our comrades who are facing legal charges, and, you know, hopefully, you know, we're having benefits to raise money for, you know, to hire lawyers. We've gotten a lot of help from the National Lawyers Guild, but we still need more lawyers, people who will step forward and help our brothers and sisters who are facing repression in the courts.
Jen?
Yeah, I also wanted to respond to the comments on the police. So, you know, what's happening to Occupy all around the country is political repression, and, you know, at its root, that is meant to prevent us from doing the work that we're doing so that our time is spent fighting cases and trying to get people out of jail. But by the same token, the police as an issue and law enforcement and the criminal justice system is not a distraction from what we should be working on. It's part of what we should be working on. And repression is an inevitable part of struggle in this country, unfortunately. And so those of us who are actively paying attention to police departments around the country know that police departments in this country are all very similar in that in the ways that they police dissent and the ways that they target communities of color and poor people. A recent study by the Malcolm X grassroots movement found that there is a black person killed by the cops every 36 hours. Mm-hmm. In this country. And that's not even counting Latino people, American Indian people, white people, anyone, you know, who is killed by the cops. That's just black people, one every 36 hours. And so we go to these cities where people say to us, well, I don't know if you know, but our police department is really under fire. It's under, you know, investigation by the Department of Justice and blah, blah, blah. And the thing is, every police department in this country almost is under fire. You know, in every major city, people are protesting the police. There are internal reviews and external reviews, and you know, all sorts of dissent happening about the police all over the country. And we have to stop thinking about each city in a bubble. This is a systematic problem with the police that we see in every major city.
And this report you're referring to was produced for the No More Trayvon Martin's campaign, demanding a national plan of action for racial justice. And again, like you said, every 36 hours a black person is killed by the cops. So hard to believe, but the report has found since January 1st, we're talking about 120 people.
And you know, the thing that is more hard to believe, well, I guess it's not, but it was shocking to me, was that before this study came out, this is a landmark study, there were no records of police murders or police violence before this that are kept by the federal government. It's all washed under the rug. And so, you know, it points to the fact that community organizing and campaigns like this are very important, because we need to be doing the work ourselves that the government is not doing on purpose, so that it doesn't have to answer and it doesn't have to be accountable to the people. And that's why the movement in so many different cities across the country is for community accountability of police, and actually having independent oversight, not just through the mayor's office, as is mostly the case.
Well, just in here in San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee recently announced that he will not be seeking to implement the stop and frisk plan after so much outrage from the community.
Mm-hmm. And stop and frisk in New York has been an absolute disaster for communities of color. It's basically a policy that seeks to take guns off the street, or that's what politicians say. But in 99.9% of stops, no gun is ever recovered. It's just a policy that doesn't work.
And that is Tom Hinsey. He is an activist with Occupy Wall Street, along with Jen Waller. They are on a road trip. They're in the middle of their road trip doing legal solidarity trainings and working to raise awareness around issues of state targeting. The project is called Less Wall, More Street, and you can find out more about it at yourcallradio.org. Michael Terry is a member of the Occupy Oakland Medic Collective. He's been an activist since the 80s and said that the Occupy movement woke him up. And now he is probably busier than ever working on with Occupy Oakland Medic and also the Anti-Repression Committee. And we've got just about 10 or so minutes left. We still have full lines. A lot of people clearly want to talk about this, and I'm getting flooded with emails. 866-798-8255. We'll hopefully have a line open in just a couple minutes. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org, and I'll try to get to as many of you as I can. Let's hear from Kevin in Oakland. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I think something for people listening at home to realize is that there's a lot going on. It's just not really getting reported in the press as much, because things like foreclosure prevention and protests at elementary schools are not as sexy as some of the things that were happening in the fall and the early spring. And then another thing to keep in mind is that different occupations have become a little specialized. So say in Atlanta, you've got Troy Davis Plaza, and they're talking a lot more about capital punishment than we are in Oakland. In Oakland, since it was Oscar Grant Plaza, police repression has naturally become part of the center of what Oakland has done. But I think in regards to the person that wrote in saying that the core message is corporations are not people, personally, I completely agree with that. And I feel like in the election season, something that Occupy can do, and that a lot of people who are drawn to this can do, is really pay attention to the way that the political system in the United States has been entirely corrupted by money. And really pay attention not just at the presidential level, but at the local level and at the state level.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Kevin. We had a caller who wanted to say there's an action coming up on September 15th called You Are Not Alone. And we'll find out more information about where that is. We've got one email from Chris, who says Occupy has not changed the debate, and their anti-capitalist rhetoric is as old as Moses. They live in a childish world informed mostly by sartorial bias based on images from childhood Monopoly games and contempt. Okay, we won't go there, but they completely fail to grasp that the capitalist of today is Silicon Valley and all its technical manifestations. Silicon Valley, in this broad sense of the world of technology, has absorbed much of the finance industries and provides not only the basis for investment, but is responsible for constructing mathematical tools. It's a very long email. The professional troublemakers, he calls you all, are the same ones who alienated protesters against Afghanistan and Iraq, who alienated the public from any sympathy for Oscar Grant, who angered BART writers by staging protests, and think that wearing masks and throwing bricks is an act of valor. How would you respond?
I haven't seen anybody throw a brick. For one, obviously she's not in agreement with
I think it might be a man. I'm not sure, actually.
Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, you know, were people alienated when we protested against the murder of Oscar Grant by a police officer? The man was shot in the back as he was restrained by two officers and shot in the back by a third. And he, you know, died from his wounds. You know, should the community not be outraged about that? Of course they should be outraged about that.
And more recently in Anaheim, I mean, the murder of Manuel Diaz was really a wake-up call. And you saw the community come out in Anaheim to protest the police who shot Manuel Diaz in the buttocks and then in the back of his head while he was being pursued unarmed. And then the police came out to crush the protests. And I don't know if you've seen the chilling video of dogs being released on mothers with children in their arms, mm-hmm. and militarized police wearing full body riot gear. The pictures are incredibly disturbing, again, in an effort to just thwart accountability.
And it always comes up, they'll use the phrase violent protest. When we're marching through the streets, you know, for the redress of grievances, chanting, shouting, very noisy. And then we're attacked by the police with clubs, with flashbang grenades, with tear gas. And, you know, members of our group are injured. And they say we're the violent ones, you know.
Yeah, also just this idea that we could make change or try to end oppression without inconveniencing anyone is kind of funny. I mean, I've had this conversation with a lot of my family members where they're just like, but it's just so annoying when I'm trying to drive downtown and I can't, you know? And it's kind of like, look around. I mean, when people are getting killed by the system constantly and, you know, whatever you're doing is helping that function, and then we make it so you can't get downtown. It's just not really comparable.
Is it important for you all to try to reach those people who might be with you on messages about inequality, but maybe don't really know what the message are like is about, or if does feel, like you said, Jen, inconvenienced?
We hear that all the time. It's that I agree with you, but I support you, but. And I want to say, well, get past the but, you know, and just get off your couch and come out and, you know, be participate in the debate. Because if you really agree with us, you know, come and be a part of the movement and help direct the movement. You participate in the things that you think are appropriate and you stay away from the actions that don't suit you. But
well, and I think our next caller might have something to say about that. Let's hear from Tony in Alameda. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm a little disturbed about is that in Oakland, I totally disagree for you to say that there isn't violence by the protesters is not true. Many people have businesses downtown. And I see this, and the gentleman who raised the issue earlier that a lot of the protesters don't really represent Oakland, I think is accurate. And I think that you're making it over the deprived area even more economically deprived. Why isn't this happening in the financial district in San Francisco? Why downtown Oakland? It doesn't make sense.
Well, we set up an encampment in Oakland because Oakland's our city, and that's where we're going to make our stand. We, you know, went to the Port of Oakland as a form of protest because that's the big, you know, enterprise that is in our town that we could shut down as a form of protest in conjunction with the ILWU workers who work there. So, I mean, we're not going to go to someone else's community. We're going to organize in our town. We're going to make the change in Oakland where we live.
And the question of economic terrorism, too. Gene Kwan called the port shutdown economic terrorism. Well, isn't it economic terrorism to not take care of the workers and the people who live in your city? I mean, like, let's be frank with the language. It's yeah.
Well, Gene Kwan, in this New York Times article that came out Sunday, told Jonathan Mueller, the reporter, that she didn't want to talk about Occupy because, quote, it was just a blip. It came and went.
There you go. I mean, that's happening all over the place. People in power and their mouthpieces, you know, the media, saying over and over again, it's dead, it's dead, it's dead, and it just won't die.
Well, Chris, who said that the Occupy movement is tired and mistaken, just wrote again and wanted to thank you all for your good responses to his email. So thank you for that, Chris. And we've only have about a minute and a half left, and we have, I'm sorry we couldn't get to everyone. We've got full lines and a ton of emails, which means that there are so many opinions about this, and people want to keep this dialogue going. So final thoughts from you, Michael?
Well, just, you know, go to our website, OccupyOakland.org. There's online forums. You can participate in this discussion.
Are you planning
online
to get involved electorally? We're getting a lot of emails about that.
Look, no, we're going to do real politics. It doesn't, in California in particular, the presidential election is settled.
But we have a lot of important propositions on the ballot.
Yeah, that's
GMOs,
true.
GMOs, mm-hmm. Three strikes. Are you?
Yeah, I'll vote, but I'm not going to vote in the presidential elections. I think people need to get out and come and organize and get involved in something real, because elections aren't going to change this. They haven't for the past 30 years. Things have just gotten worse. And we've proven that by electing a progressive to president and a progressive supposed to the mayor's office in Oakland, and see what happened.
Jen?
Yep, I couldn't agree more with that. And I'm really glad that so many people want to call into this. I hope that that means that, you know, there will be more shows about the Occupy movement, and, you know, on this station and others. We really need our independent media to be covering us. And also, you can find out more about our project at www.lesswallmorestreet.com or on Twitter at lesswallmorest.
All right. Well, sorry, Tom, we're out of time, but you can find also information at yourcallradio.org. Jen Waller and Tom Hinsey are in the middle of a road trip doing solidarity trainings. The project is Less Wall, More Street. And Michael Terry is a longtime activist, health worker, and a member of the Occupy Oakland Medic Collective. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your phone calls and emails. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of you, but we will continue following Occupy. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What messages and tactics change minds about the environment? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Annie Leonard, creator of The Story of Stuff, and Jonas Sachs, author of Story Wars, about how environmental messages are created and which ones really make a difference. What kinds of messages and stories motivate you, inspire you, maybe even change your mind and get you to act? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Does climate change need a new messenger? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.